Now Captain Kirk is going to have a complete demonstration. I want there to be no doubts whatsoever in his mind. In love with
the Nextlander Watchcast.
You feel it, Captain. You must have
the Nextlander Watchcast.
But the pain grows worse. The pain, the longing for
the Nextlander Watchcast.
You must continue to remember that, Captain. Now,
the Nextlander Watchcast. Everyone, and welcome back to the Nextlander Watchcast, where we, the members of Nextlander, watch stuff. That's the show. That's the premise.
About it.
And we're going to keep doing it.
It's truth right there, right in the title.
We say what
our
we're going to do.
Right into these microphones.
Hell yeah. If you have come this far, then you, I believe this is our 10th episode. I know I said 4 episodes means you're a real podcast, but 10 episodes means you're a legendary podcast. It's a really low bar, to be fair.
Sorry, listen, it's podcasting. Once you get past 3, a lot of people don't know this. Once you get past 3, the whole thing gets harder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's everybody has all that self-doubt starts creeping in. Mm-hmm. You got power through. You got to leave nothing on the field. Leave it all on the field. Actually, what's the expression? Leave nothing on the field.
10 episodes means you're not playing chess, you're playing poker. I don't know what that means.
That's right.
I'm not sure the writers do either.
Interesting game, this poker.
Well, we, as part of our Watchcast, when we are not watching movies, we have been watching the first season of Star Trek, the original series. We are now on to episodes 9 and 10. And I'm not going to say the last couple of Star Trek episodes were fallow exactly, because there were some things to like in those episodes, but they were not the best of the series, I feel like. But we
I would agree with what I've seen so far.
There's something there. Not perfect. The show's got some pacing issues, maybe. We'll get into it.
Yeah, but this week, I feel like we've got one mega banger and one pretty good one, too. I feel like these are some solid-ass episodes of Star Trek.
Which one is which, in your mind? Actually, hang on.
See if you can guess.
Well, you said something earlier that I think tipped me off. I'm going to say Corbomite Maneuver is the banger.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes, I think Dagger of the Mind is good, too, but Corbomite Maneuver is one of those episodes that not only feels like a mission statement for Star Trek, which is interesting where it comes in the order here, but also is just like a real good, hey, do you want to know who all these people are in this series episode?
Yeah, I guess we'll get to it when we get there, but that's kind of what I was going to say about that episode anyway.
For sure. But first up, we have Dagger of the Mind, a fun little bottle episode that really, but if you read the premise on paper here, I'm not going to say it sounds like it should be a fun episode, but I literally wrote one note for both of these episodes, and I'm going to pull it up right here. And it was for Dagger of the Mind. How did they turn this episode about illegal experimentation on prisoners into a Kirk Horny episode?
It's the magic of Star Trek.
It is.
James T. Kirk has just got that much swagger.
He super does. This
Kirk Horny episode.
Yeah.
Not only Kirk Horny, we get the company Christmas party Kirk Horny.
Dude, was just full on like, oh, I've seen Mad Men too. Yeah, I guess that was the 60s, wasn't it?
The company Christmas party.
The boss hooking up with somebody at the company Christmas. Man, just like,
It is really oscillating between like some fairly heady, you know, fairly intense, you know, descriptions of like people having their minds erased and being, you know, like brainwashed into subservience. And then also Kirk and this lady having some, you know, playful back and forth that is maybe just a little too frivolous for what else is going on here.
The Christmas party is so hilarious because, like by the time they got to Next Generation, they were trying so hard to come up with 24th century stand-ins for everything and not just say a thing that you live with currently. But, like, here it's just like, they didn't even try to come up with, like a different holiday or some other futuristic ship's function. It's just the Christmas party.
Yeah. I mean,
there's a lot in this episode that references 21st century stuff or 20th century stuff, I should say.
Is this the one?
It's the penal colony stuff. Like, they're not prisons anymore, Bone. They're not like
not cages anymore.
Yeah, they're not cages anymore.
They might as well be resorts.
Yeah, it had an interesting setup for what this vision of this future's rehabilitation for, because they don't even say criminals. I think they say like troubled minds, or I forget the kind of terminologies that they use. But it seems it feels like it has a pretty progressive bent. Like, hey, we're trying to rehabilitate and reintroduce troubled minds back into society. And Kirk is banging that drums.
Oh, he's bought in.
Yeah, and Bones like, I don't care. The
cage is still a cage.
Have you ever been to a penal colony since they started following his theories?
A cage is a cage, Jim.
You're behind the times, Bones. They're more like resort colonies
like
now.
Bones, I don't know if this is me mapping his, like, the Southern heritage of the actor onto him or whatever, but he's got that almost, like, Johnny Cash-esque, like, sympathy for prisoners, you know, like the kind of wrongly accused, like, put upon, like, the man is grinding the lowly common man under the boot heel cut type stuff.
A man needs to see sky kind of thing. Yeah. Behind bars.
There's actually a little bit of irony around that in some of the casting, which we'll get here to in a second. But here's some initial fast facts about the episode Dagger of the Mind. This episode was written by Shimon Winselberg, here credited as S. Bar David. Winselberg was a German Jew who fled the Nazi Germany in late 1930s with his family. At one point, he served in Army intelligence in World War II, and he is rightfully credited here as the inventor of the Vulcan mind meld, as this is the first episode to feature that. He was a pretty prolific writer and wrote over 100 scripts for various TV series, and often included aspects of Jewish mythology into a lot of that writing. The guest stars here, we have James Gregory as the Dr. Adams, the head of the penal colony. He was a Broadway actor who went on to a variety of films and TV roles. He was in the original Al Capone movie in 1959, the original Manchurian Candidate. He was in Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and he had a recurring role on Barney Miller. Morgan Woodward is Dr. Van Gelder, the escaped prisoner who creeps out of a box like a goddamn fucking gremlin. And here's the bit of ironic casting. If you know Morgan Woodward from anything, you probably know him as Boss Godfrey from Cool Hand Luke. He was on a ton of TV westerns, and he actually credits this role as being one of the things that helped him break out of just doing that stuff all the time. He wanted to kind of branch out from just being a Westerns guy, and that helped. But also, doing this movie, or this show, took a kind of an emotional toll on him. He said he had to take, like, a week of just resting afterward.
His performance is intense in this thing.
Oh, like, it's really capital good. A like, acting.
Dude, it's fucking, like, genuinely creepy. This is a creepy episode, and he was a big part of selling that, like...
He is. It's like somebody said on the page, it said a wild eyed man rants throughout the ship. And he was like, can do. Got it.
Man,
he is just
fucking
wild eyed, sweating the entire time, screaming back and forth on off. It is intense.
It is a great performance. I think it is the best piece of guest acting we've had on the series so far. And shout out to Morgan Woodward. Lived to the ripe old age of 93. Only just passed away a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow.
And. Oh, nice. The last guest star we have is Mariana Hill as Dr. Noel. She was in a number of films over the years, like High Plains Drifter, Medium Cool. She had a small role in The Godfather Part 2, and is in one of my favorite campy 80s horror films, Blood Beach.
I like Dr. Noel a lot.
The writing on the character is not great, but she gives it her all here.
Yeah, like there's something about her acting that is like, I don't know, there's something I like about it. There's also she's given more credit, I think, than some of the other guest, let's just say heroines that have been in the show before. She's she has to crawl through the Kirk just shoves her into an air duct.
Yep.
And it's like, go figure it out. Don't get yourself electrocuted.
Do you know which do you have any training in electrical engineering? No. Fuck. No. All right. Well, just don't cut the wrong wire.
Yeah, she kicks a dude into the electrical. I feel like she's got a lot more going on in this one. I feel like she also gets maybe the shortest skirt we have seen so far.
Oh, definitely.
Because you see basically the underside of the skirt from the jump. They just decided like, oh, this one kind of fits. Let's just go with this.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's just the 60s. I mean, the skirts have been short, but at this point, maybe too short for seeing the underbits. I don't know.
Yeah.
I saw this coming from the second that, okay, so I'm trying to remember. I think the sequence is that when they're about to go down there, Kirk asks Bones for a specialist.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I was like, okay.
Uh-huh.
That seems conspicuous. But it was when Bones called him back over the radio and said, oh, I do happen to have a member of my staff with specialties in whatever discipline,
mm-hmm.
who will be joining you,
psychology.
Like Dr. Noel. Like,
yes.
Fuck it, the second I was just like, okay, this is going to be a pretty lady foil for Kirk. Like, they are absolutely going to throw some weird romance subplot into this. I know how Star Trek rolls.
By this point,
I know
yeah.
where this
yeah.
is going.
Dr. Helen Noel, Captain. We've met. Don't you remember the science lab Christmas party?
Yes, I remember.
You dropped
yes,
in?
Yes, yes, I remember.
Problem, Captain?
Mr. Spock, you tell McCoy that she had better check out as the best assistant I ever had.
I turned to my wife when that happened, when Kirk said, I need a specialist. Can you get me a specialist with, I think he also says phrenology experience. And then
penology.
I turned to my,
he says penology.
Oh,
definitely
oh.
not phrenology. I think even by
like
then
phrenology.
They were not doing that.
Okay. Okay. Cause, I thought it was peniology because that's written on the side of a thing. And I was like, what the fuck is that a real word? But anyway, I turned to my wife and said, and 21 to 24
yeah.
brunette, please. I, thank you.
I don't know what it was about something in Bones' voice. Yeah. I was like, all right, I see what they're doing here.
Well, so an interesting detail about this is that in the original draft, this part didn't exist. It was written for Rand. And the producers were very much like, we don't want an explicit romantic entanglement with Rand. We prefer to keep some distance of flirtation there. And also, Grace Lee Whitney was already on the verge of leaving because she had been sexually harassed by one of the producers on the show.
Oh, geez. I didn't know
Wait,
about
that's
that.
Yeoman Rand?
That's Yeoman Rand, yes.
So but this one was filmed, like after Miri?
I believe so, yes.
Because that's pretty explicit by that point.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they never say that it was like reciprocal. Like, even in this one, I think they allude to, and this is jumping ahead a little bit, but they allude to the Christmas party that nothing actually happened, right? Until
yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure before we get to
there
that
was
part.
A flirtation, but it did not end up going anywhere at okay. that moment. And I think she was a little salty about that, but yeah. So at this point, like this was like the 12th episode they had filmed. And by this okay. point, like Whitney was on the verge of leaving. So they gave it, they brought this new character in. I just want to very briefly give one piece of trivia here. Mariana Hill's real last name is Mariana Schwarzkopf. And if you know that
oh,
last
boy.
Name,
oh,
she
boy.
Is a cousin of huh. Norman Schwarzkopf.
Wow.
Storm and Norman.
Storm wow. and Norman.
Okay. I feel and like they didn't make it clear up front that I thought it was an actual hookup for most of the episode until...
Yeah, they weren't clear about it.
Until yeah. it became clear later that it was not, and then there was the psychological suggestion stuff, but...
My note on that whole part is like, goddamn, they just need some kind of oversight or HR department here, because... This shit's getting out of
right,
hand.
Like they treated it so cavalierly that it was just like, but although again, when you find out it was just a flirtation, that's like somewhat less egregious.
What does he also say? He says something real shitty. Is it this episode where he's like, I don't need another woman. I've got this ship.
No,
like
that's
that.
The next episode.
Oh,
next
is that the next one?
That is literally the introduction of Yeoman Rand. So,
oh, yes.
I've already got a woman in my life. Her name's Enterprise.
Fucking God.
All right. But they need a couple of things, because the setup for this episode is also one of the dumber things I can ever imagine happening on this ship. Their transporter team really needs to restaff
it. Oh, God.
Because the whole setup is they go to this planet, they are beaming up some supplies from the planet. A box comes in.
Well, they're delivering down first.
They're delivering
they're
down first,
trade,
but they're also
yeah.
bringing some stuff up. And
it's where they establish the shields.
Yes.
Right? Oh, you got to lower the shield. You idiots. Yeah. Don't you know your protocol?
Guy doesn't know what the hell he's doing. And apparently also doesn't know how to check the biofilters, because there's a fucking dude in the box.
Well, first, I would say this. If you go back and watch it, because this is funny, maybe this is a four or an updated thing for the Blu-rays or the streaming versions. If you look on the stuff they're beaming down, there's a piece of tape that says Doctor on the front of the supplies that they had. It looks like they had to put in later. It says the doctor's name, and then there's like a piece of tape that says Doctor on the front of it. Like they forgot to write that in, stencil it in, which I thought was hilarious for the supplies.
God. And then out comes Dr. Van Gelder, who we don't really know what he is, other than we can pretty much assume that he is an escape prisoner, and he starts skulking around the Enterprise, knocking people out, stealing their clothes, looking bug-eyed.
Yeah.
And then
he's got his like you know, this is the like Austin Powers-ish, the precursor, the judo chop, right?
Yes.
Got a couple of these, just one hit, pop, and everybody falls.
And down they go. And then he storms onto the bridge eventually, in between Kirk calling the penal colony and being like, hey, oh, they called him first. I remember they called him and they're like, hey, we think we're missing a guy. Could you check to see if a guy came up?
Yeah.
And you know, there's some suspicion going about like what's going on there. But then he eventually storms the bridge and is like, don't send me back. Don't send me back.
Which one of you is the captain?
I'm Captain Kirk.
My name is Van Gelder. I want asylum.
At gunpoint?
I want your promise first. Your word that you won't take me back there, to Tantalus.
No promises. Give me the weapon.
No! No. No, I'm not going back. I'll disable your vessel first. You choose, Captain. I'll destroy your control panel.
He just like has a crazed look about him that is just very, very well acted.
It is. Like, it's not too over the top. Like, it feels
it's
like...
It's pretty over the top.
But it's believable.
It's believably over the top, yeah. And in the mid between all of this, the doctor on the planet is, like, weirdly, casual about the whole thing. He's like, yeah, you know, if you can bring him to another hospital somewhere, you're more than welcome to. But everyone's like, there's no other hospital around here that we can bring him to. Like, what are we supposed to do?
There's a bit of back and forth. There's some kind of tension between Dr. McCoy and Kirk, where Kirk, I guess his doctor is also well known.
He's pretty famous, yes.
Yeah, the guy who's running the penal colony.
Dude, they recycle so many plot elements in the show. Holy shit. Like, here is another doctor who must have been required reading at the Academy.
That's right.
This just
keeps
happening.
There was a lot of required reading at the Academy.
Kirk is way into him. He's like, hey, this is like, again, this is like rehabilitation. Everything's on the up and up. This guy's fine. And McCoy is extremely doubtful. I think Spock comes up with the test of like, ask him if they want him back, Dr. Van Gelder back. And Kirk asks him, he's like, nah, you just take him somewhere else and be okay. And that's when they decide that Bones pulls some fucking shit on him. He says like, I'm going to put this in my report, and that means you have to investigate your duty. My duty is to report this in my medical log.
And you have
your
to reply.
Duty, yeah, your duty is to investigate it in your log.
Speaking
or
of, God, man, speaking of recycled plot elements, like that happens in both of these episodes, right?
It does.
Like McCoy challenges Kirk through official channels, like via his log or whatever, right? In both of these episodes.
He does, it's a little more firm here.
So I had forgotten that it happens in this episode because it also happens like very... prominently in the next one.
It's wild. It's interesting, and you know, it goes on. I think this one we see as things go on, and I don't know if this is pacing because these things are all out of order, but you start to get this interesting relationship between Spock and Kirk where they have this Spock seems to be loosening up a little bit, and Kirk kind of some teasing, but also at the same time I feel like you're building this tension between McCoy and Kirk. That's like, I don't know what it is. Like, maybe this is in my mind what I thought Star Trek was. Kirk being a little more cavalier and McCoy being a little more by the book. but it's not really what it is. McCoy is just this kind of a cynic, and I feel like Kirk is a little bit more of an idealist. Like Kirk kind of believes in the good of mankind and these people, and McCoy's always like, this guy's an asshole, Jim.
McCoy is like the old country doctor who's been around the block
yeah.
too many times and is over all of it.
Yeah, I like it. It's neat. I'm coming around on McCoy.
I think there's, was this one or the next one, there's some tension between McCoy and Spock too, right? Like who does Spock deliver the jab about violence to, about the human tendency for violence? Isn't that at McCoy?
I believe that's at McCoy, yeah.
All right. Where he was like, what was the quote about, like your people practiced violence openly for 40 centuries, but you imprison those who practice it privately or something like
that?
Oh,
yeah. Yes. There's some interesting incarceration stuff that goes on earlier in this episode. Yeah. It kind of falls by the wayside once they're planet side.
Well, so eventually they, suspecting that something is a little off here, and with Bones's intense jabbing about it, they return to the penal colony, and Kirk brings his specialist, Dr. Noel, down with him. Not before we get a scene in the transporter room where it is, even before they really start getting into it, it is very clear there is some kind of, something happened between these
history.
Two. There is a history there. It's the first moment we were like, boy, this one's really going to veer between some tones, isn't it? And it sure does, because once they get down on the penal colony, it's pretty clear that there's like something off. Like there's maybe some Jim Jones shit going on in the background here. The prisoners are kind of walking around freely. Anytime you end up in a conversation with one of them, it feels like they are just kind of muttering, you know, very flat affect, like just rehearsed answers to things with no real personality.
A lot of glassy-eyed stares.
Yeah.
Are you trying to say that woman who came in, who is the assistant, and then goes, I love my work, there was something wrong with that?
It was that, and I can't tell if it was just a trick of the camera lighting or what, but there is a part where, at least one of those close-ups, where it looks like her eyes are pointing in different directions, like Marty Feldman. You know what I mean? It looks off.
I thought she had two different color irises.
Maybe that's what it was.
There's definitely something going on with the camera, and they're like lingering on it.
Yeah.
You're supposed to see either a faraway stare or something going on.
But the big tension here is that Kirk is starting to suspect something's up, especially after they discover the doctor's special mind beam that he uses with two very helpful knobs of on and intensity.
The neural neutralizer.
Yes.
It's a tranquilizer. They say it's just a tranquilizer. It's just to calm people down.
Yep.
But the.
You gotta do it with pills? Nah.
This is like intercut with Van Gelder also like writhing on the sickbay table and also saying something about the neural neutralizer.
And there are moments in there where like he's definitely completely out of control, but there's one where they're about to give him the jab to calm him down. He's like, no. No hyperspray. No.
Oh my God.
Please.
Like
I'm trying my best to tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you keep on hypoing that guy over again.
You get a sense pretty quickly. This device, this room is the thing that destroyed his mind.
And Kirk is immediately suspicious as soon as he sees the guy on the chair, just kind of like slack jawed, like glassy eyed, staring up into the beam. And also the prisoner, running the machine, being like totally flat affect. But Dr. Noel is not convinced. She's heard this guy's reputation. You know, she's an expert in penal psychology. And she's like, there's no way. There's no way he could be up to anything untoward.
I think that's maybe also why I love Dr. Noel in this. Because she's just like, come on, Kirk. You're not. Come on, get your shit together. This is just science, man. Like, I've studied this stuff. There's nothing that could happen here. Let's move on.
What could he possibly be doing?
She constantly is just like, let's move on. He's like, no, I want to check this out a little bit longer.
But I mean, the key detail there is that the doctor is like, hey, you know, this is an experiment that didn't work. Yes, it is the thing that eventually turned Van Gelder's mind into mush, which is why we're abandoning it. But also he walks in on them still using it. And he's like, well, why are you still using this thing that you don't think works? And that is sort of like the hook for him to start wanting to investigate more.
I like his answer, though. He's doctor is like, he says, hope, Captain, we still hope it might work.
One day.
A neural neutralizer. Experimental. Actually, we don't expect to get much use out of it at all.
That beam from above neutralizes brain waves, relaxes the patient's mind. There's no harm, of course.
And the effects are only temporary.
one question, Doctor. If it doesn't do any good...
Why do we go on using it, Captain? Hope. Yes, yes, there's always that slight chance that it might do some good in the more violent cases.
Yeah, at this point, you kind of know that fine doctor is no good, but he's doing a pretty good job of, because stuff seems to be lining up. You're like, yeah, Van Gelder maybe took that room too far, and kind of he accuses him of basically trying to self-medicate or run the thing without anybody else there.
Like testing on himself.
Testing himself, yeah.
Like he said he was, like, morally, he did not believe in testing anything on anyone else that he had not tested on himself. And that he also was impatient and therefore decided to just use it himself. By himself.
So you're like, okay, I can maybe believe that. Not that this thing is not dangerous, but...
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious to see... This is one of the few Star Trek episodes we've watched recently where I'm like, I'm curious to see how this one plays out. Like, what happened here?
And there was a good... creepy build in this.
Yeah.
Like the Van Gelder performance is pretty amazing, and like all these glassy eyed people walking around, and like the whole thing, there's just a sinister tension to everything.
Yeah.
That I found pretty effective.
Like a cult, basically. You know, like it feels like you were walking around a cult compound at a certain point.
Very much.
And
very much.
So kind of simultaneously here, Kirk is very much unconvinced and he wants to try this out on his own, so he pays a late night visit to Dr. Newell, and they give the machine a little test run where she starts implanting a hypnotic suggestion while the beam is focused on him. And there's a good little bit of acting in there where, like, whenever the beam is on, like, Kirk just kind of goes dead-eyed for a second and then off. And then what he realizes is that whenever the beam is on, he loses time. He has no idea what's happening in those moments and doesn't even think anything has happened.
Yeah, like his... What do they describe it as? Like, his brain has gone blank. It's just it is an idle brain. It is devoid of thought. While the
head
beam
empty,
is on.
No thought.
And it,
only Christmas.
I mean,
party.
Later on, they get into it's hungry like a sponge. But yes, they say that it is devoid and willing to be to take suggestion. At that point.
And while this is going on, before things really start going sideways, well, I guess I should mention that in the middle of all of this, the doctor crashes their little party and decides to immediately turn up the volume and start implanting suggestions in Kirk's brain.
Like, has her, like, manhandled, like, taken prisoner. Like, his guard straight up, like, holds her hostage while he does this. Like, it becomes very hostile immediately here.
Oh yeah, this is the clearest turn that the villain's here and continues. Dr. Noel had suggested stuff about the Christmas party, and then he just takes it and turns it dark, or says that Kirk and she,
like, you've longed for her for years, and it causes you pain not to have her.
Yes, right. That they have this. They have had this, like, kind of affair, and he's madly in love, and that's kind of how they get sent back to their rooms.
Yeah.
After that, he does. Is it here that he kind of notes that Kirk's constitution is exceptionally strong?
Yeah, like he basically is like, oh, Van Gelder was on his knees at this point,
right? Begging.
They have to emphasize how cool and how good Kirk
so cool.
is at all times.
Of course. Yeah.
And then while all this is going
I've said it before, it is working around here.
Yeah. while all this is going on the ship, Spock has the radical idea to break through to Dr. Van Gelder and use this ancient technique of the Vulcans called the mind meld. Now, Vinny, you've heard of the Vulcan mind meld before, right?
I have heard of it. I thought it was in one of the movies I saw.
It's definitely in some of the movies.
Okay, but this was not... In my memory, it was a one hand on the face kind of reading your thoughts. This was not that.
No, it kind of evolves over time to be a slightly less elaborate process than the way it is depicted here, which has basically the feel of like an acupressure session.
Yes.
But
combined with a seance.
Yeah.
Yes.
But like the my mind to your mind, our minds join stuff, like that's all in there. You know, the face touching is definitely still in there. It's just a little less drawn out in the future versions.
In my distorted memory of it, it's a little more magical.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, he goes into like, I'm gonna shift around some of your pressure points and change your blood flow, and you get the sense that they're trying to science their way through this one by distorting the rhythms of Dr. Van Gelder's body to so that Spock can, like, anyone could do this. It's just a medical technique that the Vulcans know about.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, the way it essentially is framed going forward is that the Vulcans do have very light, like, psychic abilities, like, very light, kind of latent subconscious. But, like, they're not psychic, you know? Like, they aren't psychic in the way that, like, they can just read minds or anything like that. Okay. It's they have developed this technique that allows them to essentially join consciousnesses into one.
It's kind of cool. Yeah. The way they show it is pretty drawn out, and like it should be if this is the first time they're doing it, where, like Brad said, it's like this seance where he's channeling Van Gelder's spirit into his own, and he keeps saying, we were here, and like we experienced this. And I was kind of digging it, and it looks very taxing on Spock, and like the connection is, you know, this could be dangerous, and they build up a tension with it, and you're not really quite sure where it's going. I like that.
What is our name? Who are we?
We are Simon Van Gelder.
Dr. Adams. The neural neutralizer. What did he do to us?
He can reshape any mind he chooses. He used it to erase our memories. Put his own thoughts there. He was surprised it took so much power. We fought him, remember? But we grew so tired. Our mind so blank, so open, that any thought he placed there became our thoughts. Our minds so empty, like a sponge, needing thoughts, begging, empty, loneliness, so lonely to be sitting there empty, wanting any word from him, love, hate. Live. Yes. Die. Yes. Such agony to be empty.
Empty.
Lonely. So empty. So empty.
Like they... That scene was performed very well. I kind of wish there had been a little more to come of it. Like, I think all you really, I guess you're just supposed to infer that whatever Spock saw in there was so horrifying that he felt he had to get down to the planet as fast as possible, right? Like, he never like comes out and says what he saw or anything like that.
I think what you get, what I got out of it, maybe by this time I was just inferring, was there's some artificial barrier in place on Van Gelder that is preventing him from being as forward as he'd like to be with the crew of the Enterprise, right? Something is causing him pain. Something has been put in place, some roadblock to access these memories, and the only way to do it is through Spock. And I got the sense that by kind of calming him down and melding,
right,
they realize this is an artificial process, that something malicious has happened here.
And that they were able basically to get him to communicate in a much more normal way than he could before, because there were too many weird blocks and broken things in his brain before.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a neat introduction of this concept that does become a very recurring thing throughout the rest of Star Trek. And, you know, it's a nice little juxtaposition between the previous scenes with him, where it's like, Brad, you've talked before about the way that heart monitor in sick bay, you know, kind of can sort of set the tone for stuff that goes on in that area.
It's almost like this creepy percussion.
And before they do this scene, every time that guy is talking, it's like, did you ever see that clip of the guy who is the Seinfeld composer talking about how whenever he would do the intro scenes for Seinfeld, he would perform the stupid bass hits to the rhythm of whatever Jerry's comedy routine was?
Huh, no.
That's what it reminded me of. It's like the heart monitor was just jumping all over the place note-wise in terms of, like, to match his energy.
I'm not a criminal! I do not request neutralizer.
Neuro neutralizer. Can you explain that, Dr. Van Gelder?
A device. Store. Control.
But then it gets into this very calming thrum as they're going through it. It's like, it's not menacing, but it has such a different tone to it.
I also like it, and maybe this is just old hat for any Star Trek fan out there, but it was kind of fairly new to me, that Spock is has been portrayed as this very clinical, emotionless, but you know, conflicted character. And this isn't like an empath thing. This isn't like, you know... I feel what you feel because I'm so emotionally in tune. It's got this real weird vibe to it of like, hey, this is, I'm a man of science and this is a science thing. And so when Spock has these moments that kind of dig into more of a less science and more soul mysticism thing, I like it.
I was going to say there definitely is an element of like Vulcan mysticism later on around like this.
It's neat.
I think there's something else besides the mind meld. I want to say there's some other thing maybe some other related thing.
Well, so obviously there's the nerve pinch. There's the Ponfar, which is the Vulcan mating ritual, which will come up later.
There was something. Whatever, we're getting way ahead of ourselves. I want to say there's like something between Picard and Sarek that happens. There's some sharing of memories or identity that goes even beyond the mind meld. Anyway, we can get to it in 2 years.
Yeah, eventually we'll get there. But yes, there are variations on the mind meld and how that stuff can work. But, you know, this is the establishment of it. And anyway, so he figures out that real shit, bad shit happened on that planet. And meanwhile, Kirk and Noelle are trapped there. And, you know, as soon as Kirk is kind of brought back to consciousness, he immediately is, like, desperately, painfully in love with Noelle. And she's like, no, he put that in your head. Just fucking stop it.
And he kind of gets over it.
He does. He eventually kind of powers his way back to being semi-normal.
Yeah. But there's a big problem on this penal colony. What's it, Tantalus? There's a big problem
Tantalus
on Tantalus.
Tantalus is what it's called, yeah.
They got the shields up.
Yes.
And you can't communicate past the shields. Can't tell. We know we can't teleport people back through the shield, so they're stuck. No one can come in, no one can come out.
So their only option is to find a way to get that shield down, and the only way to do that is to jam a woman into an air conditioning duct and tell her to figure out which cable to cut, and don't cut the wrong one because you'll die.
Oh, if like in 5 seconds, like you'll figure it out. Stay away from the high voltage stuff. You got this. And just kind of pushes her into the air conditioner.
Yeah, good luck.
Good luck.
And then, you know, and then they pull Kirk back into the room to continue to beam his brain, to melt his brain. And they spent a while trying to melt his brain. They really turned that knob all the way up. That thing went to 11.
I think at some point it looked like they couldn't turn it anymore, and he was just gliding his fingers over the knob in a pantomime of turning it. Like the knob just wouldn't turn anymore, but he had to keep going, and they just faked it. And Noelle's in the kind of breaker room.
Hey, give her credit; she figures it out. She sciences her way into it,
and like totally takes out a dude, a couple of guards that are there too.
Yeah, there's one guy that runs in and grabs her right after she shuts down the power grid. And you know, he kind of throws her to the ground, and he's like about to descend on her. And then she just straight up kicks him into the wires, and that guy gets fried.
I don't know why I was waiting for like the Tim Burton Batman hand buzzer thing of like a corpse to come out that was just this like charred, like charcoal. But he just has some very light makeup on his face. He just looks a little singed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So eventually Spock is able to beam down. He flicks some switches that turn off, you know, the rest of the shields, everything.
Yeah. But turns on the main breaker again.
Yes. And that...
Because in the ensuing... Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, when she turns off the power to the entire facility, which turns off the beam.
Right.
Which allows Kirk to then do some business.
To escape.
He jumps up and basically jumps up and like punches the guard and Dr. Yeah. What's his name?
Adams?
Dr. Adams.
Dr. Adams. And Adams is now in the room with the laser. The laser turned off because the power's out. But he's like semi-conscious, kind of unconscious, laid out.
Yes, crucially on the floor,
mm-hmm.
like kind of right under the chair or that is right under the beam.
Yeah. So then when Spock comes back in, he turns off the shield breakers explicitly, but turns the main power back on. And Alex,
guess who's under the beam when that happens?
Who's under the beam? Who that with the intensity all the way up?
Who would be the most, like, you know, morally correct person to have under that beam, given everything that's gone on?
Yes, the most poetic outcome.
Yes, Dr. Adams
is for the guy who is maliciously wielding the tool to be brought down by the tool.
Oh God, he is just in the microwave with no one else there, just getting his noodle fried.
Yeah, no, it's at like maximum intensity, and nobody's around to turn it off, so he is just like baking.
Well, and on top of that, there's no one around to give any kind of suggestion at all. So basically, it is straight up head empty, no thoughts.
Yeah, which is where they really lean into some of their philosophical stuff, which I think is interesting when they go, when somebody is like, oh God, Dr. Adams. And then they all kind of rush back into the room, turn the beam off, and then find Dr. Adams and he's dead. But I think it's Dr. Noel. It's like, that shouldn't have killed him. But I think is it Kirk who's like, no, you don't get it, man.
It comes up two or three times. Like there's the more protracted spiel about like, oh, the brain with like the brain is like a sponge, like desperate for thought. Mm-hmm. Remove all thought. Like it's desperate for you to put anything in there.
Yeah. I like it.
But the very end, I've got the quote here. It's McCoy and Kirk. And they're talking about like what happened and why the guy died and stuff. And McCoy is like, it's hard to believe that a man could die of loneliness.
Yeah.
And Kirk says, not when you've sat in that room.
Yeah,
like, I mean, that's the thing Van Gelder keeps saying is that like he's so alone, like that there's just, you know, it's an unbearable loneliness.
Those are the final lines. And that is like a good classic Star Trek ending to me of like a really like nicely phrased dramatic summation of the whole thrust of the episode right there in two lines of dialogue at the very end.
Unfortunately, they don't just warp speed out. They linger for a second, like a couple of 30 seconds more to the point where you're like, we're not really sure what to do now. Kirk smiles and then is like, all right, I'll see you.
Yeah. Anyway, on to the next.
It was like, because it's a heavy line to sit on, right? You think like that would be the line you say, camera pulls back to show the Enterprise fade out. But it's like, then he sits in the chair for a little while and is like, kind of does like a weird smile and is like, all head full. Let's go.
Yeah, let's just get back to it.
Yeah.
Fun little tidbit here. This planet and this and the character of Dr. Van Gelder do very briefly come up again in Star Trek lore. It is mentioned in an episode of DS9 that Dr. Van Gelder is still the head of that penal colony in that time, but very elderly by that point.
I mean, people live a long time in Star Trek, but that's pretty old.
So we assume that they corrected, like they used the mind ray or something to fix Kirk and to fix Dr. Van Gelder and all the people that were affected.
I'm not sure that Kirk was ever that broken, because other than a couple of bad suggestions, like he wasn't under the microwave nearly as long as Van Gelder was.
Does he still have a thing for Dr. Noel?
They don't seem to address that.
Well, she doesn't come back, so I'm going to say whatever that was, it resolved itself.
Yeah. I kind of used a little more context toward the end of this, like particularly about Dr. Adams's motivations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, was he just getting off on the whole thing? Like, was it just lust for power or stuff? Like, he just loved being able to manipulate people? Like, they don't really explore why he is doing this.
Like, the impression that I got is that he started with relatively, if not morally correct, then at least he thought in his mind he was doing something beneficial. You know, the experiment was designed to pacify people that are supposed to be, you know, violent offenders, people who are just not able to, you know, like regular corrective measures would not work on them. But at a certain point, that crossed over into him realizing he can basically just brainwash them into becoming acolytes and kind of just getting high on his own supply while doing that.
So it's, I like this one. It's cool. I think, what are we up to in terms of scientist dead count? Every time the Enterprise encounters a scientist, you're pretty sure that scientist is going to die.
We have at least taken out 6 to 7 scientists, if not more, at this point.
I believe it's probably a 100% scientist casualty rate. If you are a scientist on a planet, odds are now that you will be dead by the end
Once Kirk comes calling, you will not survive.
Yeah, like
well, you know, like maybe don't exceed your mandate. Like
also that
I feel like most of them. I don't want to say they've had it coming, but they definitely were flirting with disaster. You know, it's like
yeah,
setting themselves up for the fall.
This guy and the guy in What Are Little Girls Made Of, in both cases, like, have made, like, profound discoveries and are toying with, like, dangerous technology, and they just don't know when to stop, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, again, I'm not quite saying they have it coming, but, like, yeah.
Adam's had it coming. Adam's definitely had it coming.
Yeah, sure. Like, they both like, couldn't, yeah, stop themselves from...
The salt guy, he didn't have it coming.
You're right, though. Yes, yeah. He was fine. It's just...
He was trying to keep that creature from killing people. Like he just wanted the salt tablets and just said, "Now get out."
Man.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, good episode. But yeah, I think we're in store for something better here when we talk about the Corbomite maneuver. But before we do that, we need to take a very short break. So we will be right back. And we are back, and it is time to talk about one of the, I'm going to call this one of the more legendary episodes of original series Star Trek, in The Corbomite Maneuver, the episode that was filmed, it was the first episode they filmed after the pilots. It was the first series order episode, and in watching this, boy, it sure feels like that.
Yeah, sure, I can see that.
It starts with stuff we mentioned this on one of the other early ones, the like an overhead shot. Mm-hmm. You got this wild shot they never see.
There was some interesting camera work in this that I wish they did a little more of.
There's some interesting camera work. There is essentially an establishing scene for just about every major character on the series here.
Yeah.
And if there is a mission statement for what early Star Trek was intending to do here, I feel like this episode is it.
I don't know if this is something that happens more, but this watching this episode made me realize how many of the other episodes we've seen don't really just let these characters be characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like pretty much everything everybody says and does serves the main plot of the episode kind of 100% of the time. Like you don't get a whole lot of just like slice of life or like, here's these people having a conversation about what I guess a little bit like you've got that scene with like Spock and Uhura early on in the lounge, like occasionally you'll get a little bit of stuff, but like specifically it was the scene in the turbo lift of McCoy and Kirk arguing over that young officer.
Mm-hmm.
And whether Kirk is pushing him too hard and like, did you promoted him too fast? Like,
well, not to mention the bit before that where he's getting his physical and then like McCoy is like, yeah, no, you're on a salad diet now, buddy.
Right. Like I just interpersonal character stuff, I feel like would go a long way in this.
Yeah.
Do you call it a cold open? Is that what people, sure, Star Trek fans called? In the cold open, my favorite part is Spock is at the helm. Well, because Kirk, you find out later, is getting his physical, encounters a glowing cube, and then is just like, go around it.
Yeah.
And it was just to me, it was like, wait.
It's on a collision course, so I mean, what else are we supposed to do?
No, he like,
right?
stops in front of him, and he's like, basically like, go around it and keep going. And to me, it was just like, wait, can you just do that? Has Kirk this whole time just been like, go through it, go in it, touch it, lick it, smell it? And Spock's just like, I don't know, it fucking didn't bother. Let's just go around. Let's just keep moving. Like, is this what Star Trek could have been if Spock were
if you think of this as the first episode post, Where No Man Has Gone Before, maybe this is the one time they try that, because it doesn't work, is the thing. They try it, it doesn't work, and then from there on out, it's just like, all right, ramming speed, fuck it.
Yeah, like, we got to engage with this thing. But yes, that is the open, and then they go into Kirk on his back doing that weird foot thing on the wall with
more
McCoy.
Shirtless Kirk.
Yeah, sweating it up. Listen, that must be some tough exercise. He seemed pretty beat. He was not doing too well.
He put on a couple of pounds since the last physical, so you know, Bones wants to make sure he's in tip top shape.
Oh, okay. Well, this is maybe getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Hearing this is the first episode they shot also makes the treatment of Yeoman Rand in this episode make a little more sense because boy, do they just treat her like a glorified waitress in this.
Yes,
like she literally does nothing but like wait on Kirk hand and foot and like. Also act very kind of like obsequious toward him, you know, like she's just very fawning, kind of attentive to all of his needs in a way that seemed really gross.
Yeah, you know, they're establishing that, like, there is a dynamic there of he's annoyed that he has a female yeoman, especially an attractive female yeoman. And it does kind of explain how that character develops over the episodes we've already seen. Mm-hmm. But as we said, this one airs 10th in the order. And I was trying to figure out why the hell that is. It's not just a matter of executives not really having any sense of the flow of the show or any idea of what they're doing. They were just dopes in suits back then, after all. But no, the reason this episode got delayed to November is because a bunch of the effect shots were just not done when the series was set to premiere.
Okay.
So they spent a while working on those shots, and it was not going to be ready until like close to November.
Any other fun tidbits rolling in, or would it spoil some of the more ridiculous stuff in the episode later on?
No, I mean, we'll talk about the guest stars as they show up. But I just, you know, this episode was written by Jerry Soule, who is just a pulp sci-fi author, and periodic television writer and screenwriter. Baylock, as we know him early in the episode, who is the alien that is in, that eventually shows up, is voiced by Ted Cassidy initially.
Oh,
the guy
wow.
who played, you know, Rock in the previous episodes. And later on, Baylock is voiced by a guy named Walker Edmiston. Edmiston. There we go. And he did a lot of live action acting before becoming a fairly prolific voice actor on things like The Smurfs and Land of the Lost and Avatar The Last Airbender.
Oh, okay.
He played Inferno in Transformers.
Great. Fantastic.
Also, Ernie the Keebler Elf.
Okay.
Great.
There you go. And then we also have Bailey. The short-lived helmsman here, played by Anthony Call, who was primarily a TV actor, did a lot of soap opera acting in the 80s, and now mostly does narrator voices for shows like The FBI Files and A Haunting on a fourth-tier cable network near you.
Okay, it's still working, though.
Yeah, but that's kind of it. We'll talk about the other guest star later on when we get there, but initially what we find is that, yes, they are being stalked by a really malicious-seeming cube that is radiating their ship the closer they get to it.
I wish I just hadn't looked at the cast list. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
This is a complete non sequitur.
Uh-huh.
Yes, we will talk about the other guest.
We will. We will. Oh, I thought you knew who it was already.
No, I absolutely did not know who that
was. Oh, okay.
Now
we'll
I
get
do.
There.
Yeah, this spinning Rubik's Cube that is in the sky... threatening. Well, they try to back away, they try to move, that doesn't work. As they try to retreat more and more, it gets closer and closer and is pumping radiation into him until Kirk Bailey loses his shit.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So early on, Bailey is kind of presented as a guy who is maybe in a little over his head as a bridge officer. There's that conversation between Bones and Kirk where he's like, I think you might have promoted him too early, Jim. Maybe because he saw a little too much of yourself in him.
I'm especially worried about Bailey. Navigator's position's rough enough. Seasoned man.
I think he'll cut it.
Not so sure. Because you spotted something you liked in him? Something familiar, like yourself, say about 11 years ago?
On the double, Deck 5. Give me a green light.
My doctor, you've been reading your textbooks again?
I don't need textbooks to know that you could have promoted him too fast. Listen to that voice.
Yeah.
And by the time the cube starts really menacing them, Bailey just doesn't have it, man. He ain't got it.
I love the part where he's like the actual senior officers are discussing what to do, and he just blurts out, he just gently butts in, just like, "We're armed with phaser weapons, sir. I vote that we blast it." And Kirk is just like I'll keep that in mind, crewman, when the ship is a democracy.
Sir, are we going to just let it hold us here? We've got phaser weapons. I vote we blast it.
I'll keep that in mind, Mr. Bailey, when this becomes a democracy.
Yeah, it reminded me of the, what is it, we're here to protect democracy, not practice it. Yeah.
It was just this moment of like, the fuck are you doing? Like, you were a green helmsman who just got promoted.
Though I like... Spock's line, I think, is even better than that when he mouths off the Spock a little bit, and then Spock is like, whatever, 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 just do your job. And then he comes back later. He's like, doesn't mean I was scared, you know? Just because I blurted out doesn't mean I was scared. I have adrenaline running through me. It's called like an adrenal gland.
It's because I have something called an adrenaline gland.
But it's Spock saying, he's like, well, that sounds like a real nuisance.
That sounds like a distinct disadvantage.
All decks have reported green, Mr. Bailey.
Yes, sir.
And when the captain arrives, he'll expect a full report.
The cube's range and position, I'll have it by then. Raising my voice back there doesn't mean I was scared. I couldn't do my job. Means I happen to have a human thing called an adrenaline gland.
Mm-hmm. Does sound most inconvenient, however. Have you considered having it removed?
That was great. That was a great Spock.
Spock being funny is not Spock, a thing you get a ton of, but when it happens and it lands, oh boy.
He's got a very wry sense of humor.
But, so then not only that, he does that line which fucking slices him in half, but then Sulu's like, you fucking try to match wits with Spock, he's going to murder you. Like, don't cross
don't
minds.
Don't even try.
Yeah, don't even. Which was like, that's my boy Spock, just cutting him up. I love that one.
So they spend a while with this cube. They're trying to figure out what to do with it. Eventually, they're like, after I think something like 18 hours of just sitting there, they're like, all right, we're going to go. We're just going to leave. And the cube starts following behind them. It starts radiating the ship.
Yeah.
There's a pretty good tense moment where they're going to, like, you know, warp 2, warp 3, and it's like it's still gaining on them. This is a thing, Brad. I imagine you maybe have like a little bit of reference. I mean, I don't know if this is a direct reference, but you know, the first time they run into the Borg, it sure is a very similar kind of situation where it's like no matter what speed they go, the Borg cube is constantly gaining on them.
Oh, that happens all the time. It's not even just the, like, I had that thought like half a dozen times during the sequence of like, oh yeah, that sure is a Star Trek thing of like mysterious object that is just matching the ship beat for beat, every single thing they do.
And is
it besting them?
And you can go, I guess this isn't a big deal, but you can do warp backwards. That's fine. Nobody cares.
I don't think they'd show that very often in this series, if at all.
You want to get into the mechanics of how warp drive works, we can talk about it.
Yeah, like, I don't know if there's any technical problem with going backwards, but, like...
No, there's not.
Okay. They do it.
If you really want
it.
By all means,
let's get nerdy with it.
The way warp drive is said to work is by deforming space-time. It creates essentially a bubble of space-time around the ship. It compresses space-time in the front, and it kind of expands it in the back, and you're essentially surfing a wave of space-time. And that's also how they get around. They have a very convenient explanation for why there's no time dilation in Star Trek when they're flying around at thousands of times the speed of light, which is that inside the warp bubble, you are in real space. You are not moving. You are stationary inside the warp bubble.
So your time is remains relative to other times.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Like, yeah.
Or fixed to other times, I should say.
You're not traveling through space. You were kind of traveling on space time.
Or
if
like
that makes sense.
Yeah, kind of. Okay. So it's why you don't arrive like thousands of years later to a planet.
Yeah. You were experiencing the same time as everyone else who was stationary in your frame.
Sounds good to me. So they just reversed the bubble on that one.
Yeah. Basically, they would just make a bubble in the opposite direction.
Got it. Okay. Fair enough. Oh, they blow it up.
And then they blow it up. It gets too close. You know, they're past the tolerance of radiation for the ship. And finally, they're just like, all right, shoot that motherfucker. And they do. And it explodes. Minor damage. But, you know, they're kind of left scrambling because they're like, we go further in to this system, this place that we've never been in space. We're probably going to meet the intelligence that sent that thing out here, right?
Yes, and that does not take long.
No, and you know, there's some discussion about it, but at some point Kirk is just like,
that's the mission.
What's our mission, right?
Yeah.
We got to meet these people. We got to see what they're about. And it doesn't take long before the popcorn sphere finds them.
And I'm trying to find photos of what the original version of that looked like.
They're on Memory Alpha. It's actually both the cube and the orb look pretty similar. They're just not as detailed.
Okay. I was very excited when that thing showed up because it's the first time we've gotten some good Star Trek, like, astonishingly huge, like, cannot comprehend the size of this thing.
Yeah.
That they do a lot of later.
They say it's like more than a mile in diameter, I think.
Yeah, like, just dwarfs the ship, like, absolutely fills the view screen to the point that they have to zoom out, like, 25x to see the whole thing. And I was just like, finally, here is some fucking truly imposing space shit.
And I mean, look, it's a disco ball, with some baubles put on it. But like, it is like the way they scale it with the model of the ship does make it seem incredibly imposing.
Oh, Bailey's losing his shit again. Bailey can't handle this scale. Bailey is Sulu's constantly reaching over doing his job.
Yeah, that dude can't do shit. And eventually, they are contacted by Baylock, who does not initially reveal himself, but has a very commanding voice and is saying that, you know, you have breached our space. You violated our territory.
Destroyed
you
our
have
probe.
10 minutes. You have 10 minutes to pray to whatever god you have, because we're going to fucking obliterate you.
You have been examined. Your ship must be destroyed. We make assumption you have a deity, or deities, or some such beliefs which comfort you. We therefore grant you 10 Earth time periods, known as minutes, to make preparations.
Yeah, we've deemed you to be violent. You're primitive and violent, and you destroyed our buoy, I think they call
yes,
it.
Yes, they call it a
yeah,
buoy.
It's like a yeah, space buoy or whatever. This, I have to say, this is the longest 10 minutes in television history.
It goes on for at least 15 to 20, yes.
And it's, you know, they don't know what to do. They
yeah.
Gotta, it's,
they're in a tractor beam, so they can't just run away. And,
right, yes. And they keep disabling, it keeps overloading the ship's, all the ship's comms or
like
navigation
it scans,
channels.
It deep scans all their systems, which mm-hmm. causes some feedback and other issues while that's going on.
Yes.
And, you know, in the middle of all of that, they're sort of trying to formulate their way out of this. And there's a lot of people just wandering around the ship being like, fuck, man, what do we do? Like, yeah. Everyone hears the death message, and Kirk gets on there and is like, look, this is what you signed up for. This is what we do here. Stand by. We'll figure it out.
Captain to crew.
Those of you who have served for long on this vessel have encountered alien life forms.
You know the greatest danger facing us is ourselves, an irrational fear of the unknown. But there's no such thing as the unknown. Only things temporarily hidden, temporarily not understood. In most cases, we have found that intelligence capable of a civilization is capable of understanding peaceful gestures. Surely a life form advanced enough for space travel
is advanced enough to eventually understand our motives.
All decks, stand by. Captain out.
It's a pretty good speech. I liked it. It was like, yeah. It was like well done, I thought, you know, like some good leadership. Writing there for Kirk.
Yeah. That said, everybody is sweating in this. Like it, mm-hmm. like even Kirk, like everybody, you can see it really getting on everybody. I think some of them genuinely actually physically look sweaty.
Yeah. Especially Bailey, who has his biggest meltdown in the middle of all of this and is literally sent to quarters and relieved of duty because he's just being such a shithead about it.
Yeah.
And it's like the person I actually feel bad for in that scene is Bones. Because it's like, okay, you've got 8 minutes left of your life. You're going to go spend 2.5 minutes of it dragging this guy back to his quarters. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. Suck it.
Oh, what is one of my favorite lines from this episode is Sulu at some point is like, 7 minutes left. And Bailey gets up. He's doing a countdown. And then that's when they take him out of there. Like, you're relieved, sir.
7 minutes and 41 seconds.
He's doing a countdown.
Practically end of watch.
What are you all out of your minds? End of watch. It's the end of everything. What are you, robots? Wound up toy soldiers? Don't you know when you're dying? Watch and regulations and orders. What do they mean?
Bailey, you're relieved.
It was very like, he's doing a countdown! Just like Sulu. Anything else, Sulu continues to read off every minute, even though Baylock also chimes in every minute to also remind them how much time they have left.
They kind of alternate a little bit.
Yeah, but it is, and they have a sweet, sweet timer going, like an old mm-hmm. school flip rotary timer that is ticking down away. It's good. Good tension on that one.
Yeah,
like they don't know how to get. They're gonna get out of this one. Baylock won't respond anymore. To he just hangs up the phone.
They do manage to get a visual of him before he reveals himself, which I'm not sure how Spock does this. He somehow taps into their camera, like their ring camera or something. But
he says like I triangulated the source of the voice or something.
Well, that's right, because the other thing is that like the signal is coming in on their navigation sensors. Yeah. It's not their normal communicator.
Yes.
Which is weird, but so then we get a shot of this incredible fucking puppet, which literally is a puppet. We find out later, but like even beforehand, you're just like, that is a Jim Henson ass fucking alien.
That's
right from the get go.
Yeah, but like the video signal is swimmy enough that you can't really tell how bad it is, and you can't like it kind of makes it look like the mouth is moving.
It's
and stuff.
calling it Jim Henson is kind of a knock to Jim Henson. This is more
like early Jim Henson, very early.
This is some Mystery Science Theater puppetry going on here. I
instantly recognize that thing because it is like infamous. Like you see a lot of shots of that thing when you read about Star Trek.
It's pretty dumb.
But, you know, the whole idea is that it's supposed to project out as big. Like, yeah. It's supposed to be big and imposing and, you know, the big, deep, like, sonorous voice and all that. But, you know, after, you know, they kind of get down to about the 2-minute mark, you know, Spock and Kirk are having themselves a little conversation while everyone else on the bridge is there just to kind of stare at each other until they die.
Mm.
And, you know, at some point, Spock makes the analogy of, you know, it's like chess, you know, at a certain point, there are no more moves to be made. It's checkmate.
Checkmate, motherfucker.
And Kirk sits there and he thinks for a second. He's like, you know, there's another game on Earth. It's called poker.
Yeah, so that I think that actually comes up after he argues with McCoy about Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
Because they get into it. I realize this was a plot device, but at some point I was like, why the fuck are they arguing about this dipshit crew member when they have 4 minutes left to live? Like, right. They go so hard into that argument about, like, McCoy's been giving him grief the whole episode of, like, you promoted him too fast, you're expecting too much from him, like, the crew is tired. Like, Kirk also was drilling the officers hard earlier in the episode, and McCoy even then was just like, the crew is tired, like, you can't, and he just, like, wanted perfection.
We're kind of doing a Captain Ramsay thing.
Yeah,
of,
I was
like,
gonna say,
know,
this whole thing is Crimson
Tide. Some bad
time.
Shit just happened, now it's time to do some phaser drills.
But they basically get into a big argument, and this is where, again, McCoy challenges Kirk with his log of saying, like, I'm going to note in my log that I dissented from your opinion, blah, blah, blah. That's no bluff.
Oh, right. Yes. Yes.
And then the light bulb comes on, and then you see where Kirk is going with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he drops the not chess, Mr. Spock poker.
Yeah.
It's an incredible play because it really boils down to, shit, we didn't try lying before. What if we tried that? So they contact, you know, Baylock, who at this point has said, I'm not talking to you people anymore, and is like, we humans developed this material called Corbomite that coats every one of our spaceships, and if any energy weapon that attempts to destroy us, the beam will inevitably reflect it back on the attacker, and they will be destroyed. Death means nothing to us.
By the way, we don't record that one in our memory banks.
We don't want people to know about it.
We don't want to know about it, even though you scanned our memory bank. It's not in there. Anyway.
Also, I tried like 4 other ways of convincing you not to kill us before I decided to mention this.
And now I'm very cocky. Anyway, good luck. Think about that.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
This is the captain of the Enterprise. Our respect for other life forms requires that we give you this warning. There's one critical item of information that has never been incorporated into the memory banks of any Earth ship. Since the early years of space exploration, Earth vessels have had incorporated into them a substance known as Corbomite. It is a material and a device which prevents attack on us. If any destructive energy touches our vessel, a reverse reaction of equal strength is created, destroying...
You now have 2 minutes.
Destroying the attacker. It may interest you to know that since the initial use of Corbomite more than 2 of our centuries ago, no attacking vessel has survived the attempt. Death has little meaning to us. If it has none to you, then attack us now. We grow annoyed at your foolishness.
Like, it's kind of a bad play because, like, if that's really the case, then why would you even bother telling the ship in the first place? Like, just let them destroy themselves? Unless you're, you know, theoretically, you're really, really trying to convince them you're good guys. You don't want them to die.
Doesn't want Baylock to die.
But that's the thing, is that, like, an intelligence that is, on the surface, dedicated to destroying anyone that, you know, comes in contact with them and deeming them too primitive, they're not going to give a fuck.
Hmm.
They're not going to listen to this. But they do.
Or you just get a little drone to go out and shoot the ship with a little drone.
See what happens.
And then, yeah, shoot the ship, blow up the ship with another, a smaller ship that is out there, like a little, like, we'll get another one of those little buoys to go and radiate the ship, and then see if the buoy blows up. He only says it bounces back to the aggressive ship. That's really what he says. The energy weapon kind of gets returned. It's like a, you know, it's like a buff or a card you get in a video game, right? Like,
right.
Like
extra shield.
Vest of thorns or whatever that would just returns damage to attacker. But yeah, that's it, make them sweat is what Kirk says.
Yeah, because they try to get back on the communicator and they're like, there's like, no, make them sweat. Make them wait.
Make them sweat for 2 seconds. Then it goes.
Yeah. Well, the thing we learn is that the smaller ships that come out of this orb maybe don't have weapons, but they sure do have tractor beams.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they're like, all right, so here's what we're going to do. We can't figure out if you actually have this or not. So what we're going to do is we're going to tow you to a planet where we're going to dump your asses, and then we're going to drag your ship out into space and blow it up not near anything.
Which is great. So they get a
tugboat pulling it along.
A little tiny version of that giant orb now is just tugging this thing, the Enterprise, across space to their eventual demise.
Yeah.
And then cue perhaps the longest sequence of people looking tense on the bridge and shifting back and forth and dramatic music swelling I have ever seen in
my
life.
God, it's
so good. I could not believe how long that went on.
It goes on for so long. The people on the bridge, I feel like, have it a little bit easier because there is a kind of a consistency and a bit of a pullback.
Right. Yeah.
The people in the hallways. Yes. Oh, it's
to
so embarrassing.
I forgot that they go full like submarine or just like ship on the ocean of people like flinging themselves back and forth across the hall as the ship tilts back and forth.
To
the one
right.
guy who's wearing like a fucking like life vest for some reason, who's just like, oh, he just keeps slamming into the walls.
But again, that sequence feels like it goes for like 5 minutes.
Yes.
I think it does. It goes for at
it's
least
so
four.
So long. And they have contrived some plan. I never quite got it of like, oh, you're going to like wait until, oh, they're probably using most of their power and shit that small to tractor beam us. You're going to wait until he goes left and you're going to shear right kind of shit.
Yeah. Like, it's stressing the tractor beam.
Yeah. Like you're just going to like wait and like swerve and floor it at just the right minute when I say, and like, that's what they do. And then it just goes extremely over the top.
Oh,
They get out of the tractor.
They make it out?
Yeah, but the episode goes extremely over the top. Also breaks.
They make it.
Oh, come on.
They make it out, and Kirk is still on his, we've got to meet new alien life. We have to go see if Baylock is okay.
Well, Baylock's dead in the water.
Right. Yeah, the ship
life
is burned
support
out.
System, they're saying,
yeah.
is failed.
Oh, right. Yes, that's right. And so they're okay. They're like, oh, we have to go check on him.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, man.
Takes a crew over, including Bailey, for some fucked up reason. And
I think Kirk says something like you need to see the unknown up close. I owe that to you, or something like that.
Yeah.
And oh my god,
they go to the transporter. The best part is they go to the transporter room, and they're like, Scotty's like, yo, you need to duck. Kind of low ceilings in there.
Yeah, we're reading pretty cramped over there.
And so they get on the ship, and who do they meet? Well, first they meet the puppet. It was just kind of sitting there.
I felt a little relieved when I found it was actually meant to be artificial.
Yeah.
Like, felt like, okay, episode, you have justified yourself.
Yes.
Apparently this civilization is suitably advanced that they can build giant space orbs with incredible power, but their puppet-making technology is really lagging behind.
Yeah, you got a little Wizard of Oz stuff going on here, because 2 steps later...
Who do they find?
The most maniacally cackling child.
Oh my gosh.
Alien ever, played by Clint Howard.
Oh my fucking lord. Is that
Did you know it was Clint Howard?
I knew it was Clint Howard.
I was like, who is this kid? And then I looked it up and I was like, of course it's Clint Howard.
That's what I stumbled on a few minutes ago when I was looking at this episode page.
Holy, my notes are just, what the fuck are we doing here? Because not only is it a 12-year-old, 7-year-old? How old?
Six.
6-year-old.
He was six?
6-year-old.
He was six.
Clint Howard with baby teeth, just mishmash baby teeth, adult teeth coming in, with eyebrows glued to his head, with a bald cap on. He is also dubbed with an adult voice, like we said earlier.
Is.
Throwing his head back. And
it's the numerous times that he just like throws his head back and just like cackles. Like, I just like, could not handle it.
It's so good. God. Like, he's just this little like baby space pimp out here in his fucking space orb. It's amazing.
Just laughing. Like,
oh man.
But
Bacchanalian motherfucker.
Like, yeah, like insists that they share a drink with him before they discuss matters.
Which is unfiltered apple juice as far as I can tell.
When you see him do that laugh, when he puts his head back, it's hilarious because it is, for the most part, he's actually pretty good. But it's only that laugh is like when you see a six-year-old trying to follow acting directions of like,
yes,
just laugh like you've never laughed before. And it's like closed eyes, head back, like, ha amazing.
You can see his fillings.
Oh gosh!
Like, this clearly
amazing.
They have not so advanced dental work on this planet.
Oh
yeah,
man.
I mean, like, apparently the original script, you know, it was supposed to be more of an adult looking alien, but Gene Roddenberry was like, we need something weirder, and boy, they found it in Clint Howard at 6 years old. Holy shit!
They sure did. This one stands the test of time on the weirdness scale.
Yeah,
Kirk not phased though. Just rolls with it. Yeah, sure.
All right, weird space kid. We got it.
We got it. What's the deal? And this is where I started to get confused.
Mm-hmm.
This is maybe one of the most segments in their Star Trek's philosophical dissecting of the human/alien condition where I was confused. Baylock is pretty psyched. He's got visitors. He's lonely. He's like, you know, I'm out here in deep space all alone. Got this giant ship. I don't get a lot of visitors. This is pretty cool. Was he ever really going to blow up this ship, or were they both bluffing and playing poker? Because he's kind
of
okay.
That was my assumption, was that it turned out that the irony was that they were both bluffing.
Is that so? It's like, I needed to see the nature, like what you guys are made of, kind of thing.
Yeah, he says specifically that he was testing them. Like, he does not elaborate on what that test was supposed to prove, other than, you know, how advanced are you? You know, how benevolent are you? But like, you know, he never says, "Oh, I was never going to blow up your ship." He just says he was testing them.
Yeah, so I was kind of confused there, and then maybe a little confused, but maybe not confused, why Kirk just offloads Bailey to them.
Before that, there is the offhand reference, which implies that at an incredible speed, he has learned the entirety of human history by scanning their databanks, because he just straight up drops a Jekyll and Hyde reference referring to the puppet.
That's true.
But like, you know, obviously this is a super intelligent being. The you know, technology is pretty damn advanced. The drink technology is fantastic.
Uh-huh.
And you know, he's like, we should do an exchange of ideas. That feels like a thing that would be cool. Like, I'm out here alone. I want to know what you guys are about. And you know, at some point, like, yeah, Kirk proffers Bailey, because he's like,
Bailey. I think Bailey volunteers. He asks,
well, he
Bailey
looks at
like
him.
He asks Bailey, like, we'll need to find a volunteer, won't we, Bailey? And then Bailey steps up and says, yeah, I'll do it.
Hell
like,
yeah.
Like,
and
why?
Like,
seems like a weird turn for his character.
Well, the thing, you know, the Baylock is like, ah, you're sending one of your best then. And then Bailey's like, oh, no. No, I'm not the best. I'm going to fuck up all over the place. But you'll get a better sense of who we actually are through that.
Yeah.
Which is, okay.
And Kirk is like, and I'll get a better officer back.
If you ever get him back.
Right.
I have no crew, Doctor. I run everything. This entire complex from this small ship. But I miss company. Conversation. Even an alien would be welcome. Perhaps one of your men. For some period of time. An exchange of information. Cultures.
Yes, both our cultures would benefit. Do you know where we can find a volunteer, Mr. Bailey?
Me, sir, I'd like to volunteer.
Ah, you represent Earth's best, then.
No, sir, I'm not. I'll make plenty of mistakes.
But you'd find out more about us that way. And I'd get a better officer in return.
But it's, you know, there's a certain novelty to that idea and a certain thing, but it really does feel like Bailey is like the epitome of failing upward in this episode, right? Like, he kind of sucks at his job, so he gets a big old promotion onto the space baby pimp ship where he gets to fucking hang out and drink cool juice.
I got to kind of get the sense more that Bailey knows he's going home from Starfleet after this mission. Like, Bailey's going to be assigned to an outpost with one of those scientists that's going to die in 50 years when the Enterprise comes back. Mm-hmm. And Kirk is like, what about a Bailey? And, you know, mm-hmm. Bailey's like, listen, I know I'm being sent
Can
home
I
after
interest
this
you
one.
In the most mediocre man on my staff?
Yeah, and Bailey's like, I'm in trouble. Everybody, like, what am I going to sit at the console after all of this stuff? Mm-hmm. No. So Bailey's like, listen,
we've already proven that Sulu can do my job and his at the same time. So
fair.
It's a win-win for everybody. Kirk was not necessarily talking about Bailey when he said, I'm going to get a better officer back after this. Kirk was talking about the replacement for Bailey. He's going to get at the helm
that too.
After this. So like, win-win for everybody. Bailey doesn't have to go, you know, work on the whatever the Starfleet's version of outpost in Siberia is. And he gets to hang out with baby Clint Howard, drinking his Trania and laughing maniacally. I don't know what's going on here. They kind of walk off into the end of the set, and that's the end of the episode. They hit the wall on the set in the darkness and then have to stop moving because there's no more set, and that's it.
Yep. That's pretty weird. Much it.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. Once I saw Clint Howard, my brain stopped processing a lot.
But, you know, two things. Again, one, this is an episode that, again, has every principal cast member in it. And, you know, everyone gets a moment, you know, kind of to establish who they are. Like, Scotty has some engineering problems. Uhura's doing communicator stuff. Sulu, finally, you know, this is the first time this is the first time he is the helmsman. You know, they establish a lot in this episode.
Yes.
Bones gets a, I'm a doctor, not a blank line.
Yes. What is he? Like, I'm not
a doctor or a moon shuttle conductor?
What am I, a doctor or a moon shuttle conductor?
Yes.
And then they walk out of the room, and then that's when he just is like quietly like, if I jumped every time a light flashed around here, I'd end up talking to myself. Like,
yes.
It's a great little character moment.
Yeah. There's a ton of that stuff, a ton of that flavoring in there that literally lets you know who these characters are and what their mission is, because as ridiculous as the end of this episode is, this is a fundamental style of episode in Star Trek of gigantic threat thing that is imperiling the ship that turns out to be something that it is not and allows them to understand a culture and or a species or an intelligence that they otherwise never would have.
Frequent trope even into subsequent series.
Yeah.
I think from what I've seen so far and what I've heard, this has everything, right?
It does.
It's got Kirk having to go show that he is going outside. It's not necessarily illogical, but he's got to do bluffing, right? He's got to, it's a very Kirk maneuver to where Spock is chess, he is poker, right? And like, that's, you got a shirtless Kirk, which is great. You know, got to have it. You got some sniping between the crew going on as the tensions are going. You got crew members having to fake like the ship is under fire and like bounce around. Really checks all the boxes, I think.
Yeah, this is the blueprint.
And it goes weird.
Yes.
Goes extremely weird.
60s weird.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know,
it's got a little casual sexism in it too, just for good measure.
It's got Kirk bagging on salad because he doesn't want to eat his greens. He's got Yeoman Rand laying a napkin in his lap. Like, that's her responsibility.
What the fuck was her coming in like right in the middle of the climactic moment of danger with a pot of coffee and just serving him a pot of coffee, and they're like, and they're like, I forget, some
coffee's
system was
here.
Out. Yeah. Some system was
All
out.
All of the systems were out. It's like, how'd you heat this up?
Yeah, she's like, oh, just grabbed a hand phaser, like zap, hot coffee. Like, it's just like, they just reduce her to this like subservient role where like the ship is about to explode and all she cares about is making sure Kirk has his coffee. Like, it just seems weird.
I feel like the role of a yeoman is supposed to be kind of a captain's administrative assistant, but in this context, they really are just treating her like she's his secretary. And
Or servant, even. Yeah. Like, it's just a little egregious.
But, I mean, later on, even as much as the Rand character is, you know, kind of problematically portrayed, like, they give her more stuff to do that isn't just waiting on Kirk hand and foot, but this is how they choose to establish her.
I think that stuff bothered me some, but I think in the context of this, you know, I think they are, like, setting her up as this intern, Kirk's intern.
Yeah.
Like, that he is just kind of taking...
and it's the thing that explains that there is some kind of tension between them, which you're just kind of meant to infer from the previous 9 episodes without doing the legwork.
But the thing that almost made me more annoyed at this is the whatever size carafe they have to use for their coffee is so skinny. We get like one or two cups out of that thing.
Yeah.
It's ridiculously small. It's like
maybe it's just very potent coffee.
Oh yeah, maybe in the future the coffee is just that much more potent because they're little paper cups too. They're little like the cups you get in the waiting room at a dentist, tiny cups of coffee.
I mean, the thing is, it seems like all the yeomans are basically just doing this on the ship. Like there's another, I think a couple episodes ago, there's another one at the beginning of the episode that shows up. And it's straight up, it just feels like it's the cigarettes girl. Like she just shows up for 5 seconds and then disappears.
Has a tray of like hot dogs, mini cocktail wieners, and is just holding it on the bridge. Yes. But yeah, I like this episode a lot. I think it's it's got a lot of great stuff in it, a lot of fun character work. This one ranks up there for me, and that ending is a tough one to beat.
Yeah. It's like, it's a great curveball.
It's. Yeah. I can't believe,
dude.
Even at the time for this show, I can't believe a bunch of adults sat in a room and were like not laughing their asses off. Or maybe
I bet they were.
You think they were? Okay. Or you're like, this is good sci-fi. Or you're like, this is so fucking dumb. Everybody's going to love this. Like, what was the tone on it? Like, oh, this is a good alien. This will have people thinking. Or it's like, oh my God, how much stupider could we make this? Put eyebrows on him. Yeah, put eyebrows on him.
Look at a lot of 60s like fashion and design and stuff like that. Like, I don't know what everybody was on, but things were strange.
It was a very campy time.
I may have to go back and watch that ending again just to see Clint Howard hamming it up some more. Oh, it's so fucking dumb.
I wish he came back. I wish there was more of him.
It's a bananas thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, that puts these two episodes in the book. Like we said, two of the better ones we have watched so far. In 2 weeks, we will return to Star Trek yet again. And this is the moment, folks, where we're going back to the pilot. The first pilot.
Oh, okay.
So in 2 weeks, we will be watching the original Captain Pike pilot, The Cage. And in addition to that, we will be watching the two-part episode, The Menagerie, which directly references many of the scenes from The Cage and is sort of a continuation of the story from that pilot episode. So technically, this is a three-episode one, but I'm going to be honest, there's about one episode of new material in that two-parter.
Wow.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. All right.
So look forward to that. But next week, we return to the world of film, and we will be doing a pair of movies for September that are movies that Brad has never seen. And when you mentioned you had not seen the first one of these, I nearly fell out of my chair because...
I guess it's possible, but if I've ever seen it, I do not remember it.
I truly believe if you had, you would. We are going to be watching Predator, 1987, from... John McTiernan, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, and a cavalcade of testosterone-heavy dudes. And then a couple weeks after that, we will be watching Predator 2, starring Danny Glover. That will be our movies for the month of September. I am very excited about those.
Same.
All right. Well, with that in mind, we are going to wrap up for today. Thank you, as always, for listening. Thank you, as always, for watching along with us. Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Vinny. And we will see you next time on the Nextlander Watchcast.